Well, my next guest, Dutch historian writer Ian Beruma, has earned himself quite a distinguished reputation, I think, as someone unafraid to wade right into current dilemmas where others may fear to tread. Do you remember his work years ago on Murder in Amsterdam about the interface between Western values and Islam? But his latest work, just released in Australia, has jumped right back to a particular year, which he now judges to have bequeathed us, my generation and our children, something so precious we've barely acknowledged it. The year is 1945. Yes, the year World War II ended, of course, something that rolls off the tongue easily enough. A time when millions across Europe and Asia were displaced and people were reeling from the horrors they'd encountered. But Ian, born 6 years later in 1951, says the real gift of the people of that time was the result of a sort of post-war battle of consciousness, a determination not to return to old ways, to create a new world order, a new dawn, while at the same time recreating normalcy amidst those who also believed the recent past had to be confronted. It was quite a dance. And the point is, he said, they pulled all this off with epic resolve. He's here now speaking to us from his home in New York, where he's Professor of Human Rights and Journalism at Bard College, to discuss Year Zero, a history of 1945, and why he thinks that ground needs to be traversed anew. Ian, welcome back to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
You're one of several fine historians and analysts, I notice, really looking back to this period and also into the 50s and so on, and saying, we think we know what happened post-war, but it's as if you're rediscovering, dare I say, a whole new sort of majesty in that period. Is that how you see it?
Well, it was a very mixed picture because the book comes in several parts, and the first two-thirds are actually much gloomier because they describe all the horrors that usually follow wars. In fact, always
True.
Do. We see that in the Middle East. Wars create civil wars. They exacerbate divisions that already exist in societies. They create a thirst for revenge and so on. So, in fact, the aftermath of World War II was, in many places, extremely bloody. Yes, there was also the resolve and the idealism to create a better world that was more equal, a world in which great wars would no longer occur and so on, but it was also a very violent period.
There's plenty of that and plenty of just the whole business of post-war reconstruction, the sordidness of quite a lot of it. You know, in Japan, you make the point that, for instance, this is just a small point, there was no anti-fraternization policy as occurred in Germany between the victors and the vanquished. And as you put here on page 35, sexual intercourse took place wherever space could be found, mostly on the floors or in the halls and corridors of the improvised brothels. And you go on to really describe some fairly basic arrangements.
Yes, Japan in the beginning, there was no ban on what they called fraternization with indigenous personnel. The ban came a little later, never very effective. But the ban was, of course, in Germany and Japan against fraternization with the former enemy was not so much to do with any kind of sexual behavior. It was because people were paranoid, officials were paranoid, first of all, about spying and violence and that kind of thing.
Look, that is absolutely there. There's no doubt about it. But what I got from the book, too, and you say you, in a way, you sought to recreate what your father went through, for it helps you to make sense of yourself and indeed all our lives in the long dark shadow of what came before. Now, did you, as a result of your research, make more sense of it?
Well, yes, I think I did. Not so much perhaps about my own personal life, but I think that there are really two things that went into the writing of the book. One was the realization, really, if we look at a very recent history, and in the Middle East in particular, of wars that were embarked on for rather misguided reasons by the United States in Iraq and other places, but we see it in Libya, we see it in Syria, that any kind of military intervention and any kind of war leaves chaos and mayhem in its wake. So I wanted to illustrate that by going back into the history of 1945 to show what the world is like when it's in chaos and ruin. And the other thing is that the idealism that went into creating a better world and building institutions that might prevent conflicts such as the United Nations, a united Europe, social democracy, Churchill was the great war hero, was voted out as soon as the war was over in Europe. That world, in some ways, is coming to an end, partly because the idealism of the time is no longer there. The fear that without those institutions, European countries will go to war again is no longer there. The end of the collapse of the Soviet Empire, in some ways, has had the unintended effect that anything to do with idealistic politics or any kind of utopianism, anything to do with socialism, has really gone as well. It's been washed away with the bathwater of communism.
Right. So that these big legacies, the human rights legacy, the welfare state legacy that you say, this is the majesty of it that I was referring to, you think they're a bit brittle, do you?
Yeah, well, I think they're certainly more than fraying at the edges because there is no longer really the public support of it. It was also very expensive, the welfare state, and so it started really not coming to an end, perhaps, but certainly a great dent was put into it from the Reagan and Thatcher era. So I think we're living in a world now that we seem to be drifting a bit. We don't really know where we're going. There are more and more conflicts. And so a lot of the things that people of my generation took for granted, like continued prosperity, economic growth, relative peace, and so on, if you were lucky enough to be in the prosperous Western world, that a lot of these things that we took for granted are no longer so clear. And I think that we live in a darker period now than the one that I grew up in.
In a sense, what your, I think, main thesis is that people did not want to go back at the end of the war to their old ways. Something had shifted. And in a sense, even if you did want to go back to pre-war days, it was impossible. I just wonder if you could retrieve that sort of sense that you glean from people.
Well, that depends a bit on who you were and what your position was in society. War is also, in some ways, it stirs things up. It everything is turned upside down. So it also, the chaos of war and the aftermath of war creates new chances. If you think of, for example, the position of women in society in war, because of the war, they suddenly took up positions and had jobs in industry and other things that they hadn't had before. And so it improved their social position in some ways. The same is true of racial emancipation. The blacks who fought in the U.S. Army during the war did not want to go back to the way things had been before the war. Now, conservatives, of course, were rather worried about these developments and did want to restore women to their traditional place. Mm. Or if you think of the European imperial powers, they wanted simply to go back to places like Indochina and the Dutch East Indies and Malaya and Burma, and as though nothing had happened. Now, that, of course, was not the case because they couldn't go back because the local population didn't want any part of that.
Ian Baruma is my guest on Saturday Extra. He has a new book out called Year Zero, A History of 1945, because he thinks we should understand far more than we, or revisit this epic year for the benefit of some edification about the way we live now. In fact, this issue about the colonialists just seeking to re-establish the old world is very obviously important to Australia because we live in this region. It was as if, despite the brutality of the Japanese in Southeast Asia, there was a preference for the Japanese to lord it over them rather than the Western imperialists. Was it really that suddenly a whole lot of Asian people saw other Asians with the capacity to put Westerners to the sword, and that this was the profound shift that occurred in the middle of the 20th century?
Well, the Japanese occupation of Southeast Asia showed the vulnerability of European and American power there. That was really the beginning of the end for Western colonial power in Asia. It also, in some ways, the Japanese, even though they were very brutal, their propaganda of Asia for the Asians and liberating Asia from Western colonialism, even though self-serving, in some ways gave Asians in colonies a new sense of pride that they should stand up for themselves and had the right to rule themselves. And I think as I said just now, that it also extends to people of classes that had been dominated by upper classes. And so that the war had positive consequences as well as creating chaos and mayhem.
Mm. And of course now we have, as you say, quite a lot of talk about the decline of the West, just skipping forward 60 years, of the US as well as Europe. I wonder if that 60-year gap is, it's often amazing things do occur 60 years after major conflagrations. I wonder if it's a relatively predictable development. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, nothing is predictable entirely. Also, it's easy to exaggerate the decline of the West. It's perhaps not so much a decline as that other parts of the world have risen up again. And in some ways, this is a natural thing to have happened, because it wasn't so very long ago that China was a great power and a great civilization. And the subjugation of China by Western power was a relatively recent event. And so that China has reasserted itself as a great power is well, nobody would have predicted it 40 years ago, but in hindsight, it's not so surprising.
Mm. You write at the end about your father, how you and your sisters took your father to Berlin for New Year's Eve 1989 after the wall had come down. How monumental was that for your father?
Well, my father was forced to work in German war industry. He was a Dutch student at the time. And if you didn't sign a loyalty oath to the German occupation, you were forced to work in the German factory. And what happened to my father is that he was forced to go to Berlin, experienced the Battle of Berlin, the bombing day and night. He was almost shot by a Soviet soldier. He collapsed from hunger and fatigue. He was in displaced persons camps and so on. And then he came back to Holland in 1945. And he was not a traumatized person, and nor was he really particularly anti-German. But certain things did stick with him, and one was a horror of fireworks and big bangs, which reminded him of experience. And we'd only been back to Berlin once since the war, and 1989, when the wall came down, seemed a perfect occasion. So we went back and celebrated on New Year's Eve, and it was a marvelous scene. People from all over the world were celebrating, champagne corks were popping and so on. And near midnight, the fireworks suddenly went off, and we lost our father in the crowd. And we looked for him. We couldn't find him. Went back to the hotel, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, he stumbled in, and it turned out that my father, of all people, had received a great sort of fire rocket between the eyes around midnight in Berlin. And the reason I end the book with that anecdote is that 1989 was seen by many people in the world as the final end to World War II, now that Eastern Europe, Central Europe, was finally free from the Soviet Empire. Now this was the end, and the brave new world would truly begin. And President Bush talked about the New World Order. Francis Fukuyama wrote that famous essay, The End of History, and so on. And I told the story really to show that history is never at an end. Things are never as rosy as you think. Mm. New problems immediately occur, and history will never leave us alone.
Well, Ian Berouma, thank you very much indeed for joining us, and I'm sure our listeners will send us lots of responses after they've heard you. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Ian Berouma, he's Professor of Human Rights and Journalism at Bard College in New York State, and his book Year Zero, A History of 1945, is published by Atlantic Books, and it's full of some extraordinary anecdotes as well as his insights about the long-tail legacy.